spend the whole show today with Darko Treshner. He's the artistic director of the Hartford Stage. He's got an amazing version of Kiss Me, Kate up right now at Hartford Stage. It'll run through the middle of June, through June 14th. In recent years, it's been a quiet time. All he's done is win a Tony and an Obie just a few weeks ago and run a terrific regional theater. I've never really, I feel like, you know, you've been here quite a few years. 2011 it was announced, all right? Right? Is that when you,
yeah.
But I feel like I've never had a protracted conversation with you. So I'm really looking forward to this. I've been enjoying your work so much. We'll talk a little we'll talk a little bit about your life too. But let's start with Kiss Me, Kate. So this is a really interesting property, this Cole Porter musical from what, 1948, right?
Yeah, 48.
So this you've done the original musical, the Tony-winning original musical, Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder. This is your first musical revival, I think, at Hartford Stage, right?
At Hartford Stage, yeah.
So why'd you pick it?
You know, Cole Porter is my favorite songwriter, and I think he's America's greatest musical theater songwriter. He wrote his own music and his own lyrics, and it's what I like to listen to in the shower. You know, it's my favorite thing. I just love his lyrics, and and I started thinking about this show 25 years ago in a completely new way. So it's only taken me 25 years, but there was that album, Red Hot and Blue, that came out where artists like David Byrne and Sinead O'Connor and, you know, Fine Young Cannibals, they reinterpreted Cole Porter songs. Mm-hmm. And it was a wonderful album, and it meant a lot to me at the time. So I started thinking about doing Kiss Me, Kate. So we're not doing an 80s, 90s techno version of Kiss Me, Kate. That's not what we're doing.
No.
But that's when I really started thinking about it. And then it seemed like a natural match because, you know, I've directed 25 Shakespeare plays. So, and one of the few Shakespeare plays that I absolutely don't want to do is The Taming of the Shrew. So I have huge problems with Taming of the Shrew, but I don't have problems with Kiss Me, Kate.
Well, I want to talk about that. And first of all, we should say that so that for those of you who have never seen Kiss Me, Kate, so this is a musical that's kind of functioning in two different levels. It is the proverbial play within a play. So you have a musical about actors and a director-actor who is staging Taming of the Shrew, although it's pretty clear that this version that they're going to do is going to be taking liberties with Taming of the Shrew. And then, so that's sitting within the musical, which is Kiss Me, Kate. Kiss Me, Kate is the musical about the fact that there's a mistaken identity, there's some thugs who are showing up to collect a debt, there are some romances that are going on and off the rocks. So you've got two different plays, and Porter also, impressively, is writing in two different musical styles. He's writing in kind of an almost light opera style for the stuff that's within the Shakespearean part of it, and then writing somewhere between Guys and Dolls and West Side Story for the, you know, the other
part. Well, the operetta part is Wunderbar, that number. That's the leads remembering their youth, and they rekindle their relationship through Wunderbar. And then Shakespearean numbers have this faux Renaissance feel, but it's almost a joke because very quickly turns kind of into 1948, 1950 Apache dance numbers, you know, suitable for Jack Cole style choreography. And then, you know, there are the numbers, I think very influential numbers like Too Darn Hot, where you can hear, you know, West Side Story a decade before there was a West Side Story. So.
As a little boy, I knew Jack Cole.
Did you?
I did, actually.
Amazing.
Yeah, he directed directed a show that my father wrote. You know, you say you don't want to do Taming of the Shrew. It's the one Shakespeare play you don't want to. I'm assuming because of the sexual politics of the play, they just kind of don't translate very well.
Well, you know what's interesting is I've directed The Merchant of Venice twice. Mm-hmm. And after horrible things happen to Shylock, you can play that last act in a very bittersweet, harsh way. But something about Kiss Me, Kate, you know, it seems to me that it's not Kiss Me, Kate, The Taming of the Shrew. It seems to me that it's supposed to provoke laughter and cause pleasure to the very end of the play, which is kind of about this zombification of a strong woman. And so I can't stand that. And you really don't have to deal with that in Kiss Me, Kate as much because Lily Vanessi is a strong character through to the very end, you know, and both the men and the women in the show, I mean, they're not exactly role models. Mm-hmm. You know, they lie and they cheat, they sleep around, and everything is forgiven. But the playing field is much more even, you know.
Although you're still struggling a little bit. In 2015, I think, I love this production, but you're still struggling with humor that comes from a man raising his hand to a woman, right? I mean, you have a man striking a woman, hitting her hard enough so that she can't comfortably sit down afterwards.
Well, you see, what's interesting is if you look at the production, she beats him about 10 times as much. And she's little, like Anastasia in our production, Anastasia Barzi, wonderful actress. She's small, and that was the reason why the man gets a pummeling. Mm-hmm. So she grabs his crotch and smacks him in the mm-hmm. belly and pokes his eye out and stuff. So we did that very carefully. So actually, I know people always go like, oh, it's a man beating a woman. It's just actually that's not exactly what's going on stage. We made sure that she's the much more violent one. And in fact, it's in the script that she's the one with the bad temper.
You grew up in the former Yugoslavia, I think what's now Serbia, right?
I was born in Belgrade and the family's from all over the country.
Did you grow up with an awareness of American musical comedy?
Yeah, pretty early. I have no idea why, but this is really funny, but they showed some MGM musicals in Yugoslavia. And usually that was not, you know, communist television. That's not what they showed. But it's funny because I saw these MGM movies and I got to United States and I heard that there was this one great musical, film musical, The Sound of Music. Mm-hmm. And so I was watching it, and I'm expecting the glamorous leading lady, and, you know, there's this, like, nun and flat shoes and a bad haircut. And then, you know, halfway through the movie, you meet the Baroness, and finally I was like, oh, well, this is the leading lady. So I couldn't believe it when he ended up with a nun with a bad haircut. You know, my mind was so weaned on the MGM musicals, I couldn't even process it.
I feel as though the American musical comedy is a kind of genre that exists only here. I mean, obviously there's a British counterpart to it, but I feel like this is a thing that sits all by itself.
American musical comedy, I think it's America's greatest contribution to theater. It's a specifically American contribution. You know, later on, the Brits come in with Phantom and the 80s, you know, British musicals, but, you know, I think they're much more devoid of personality. Mm-hmm. I frankly prefer. And what I love about American musical theater is that it was a triumph of personality. Mm-hmm. You know, Ethel Merman, Carol Channing, Mary Martin, and many men, you know, that it was very much the success of American musical theater. It was connected to very idiosyncratic personalities, which is why I prefer it.
Also, I mean, the theater of that time was the popular music to a great degree of that time.
So
in 1948, I'm assuming, I mean, the way that this works in 1948, I'm assuming, or 49 maybe it took that long, Too Darn Hot was probably something of a hit. In other words, some of the songs
or pretty
musical,
soon. Yeah. Or pretty soon, yeah.
The
you know, what's interesting about my career is actually I was discovered by Marge Champion, and she... you know, she had the Walt Disney career. Mm-hmm. He drew her as Snow White. And then she and her husband, Gower, they had the MGM career. They were kind of the Fred and the Ginger of that, like, 40s, 50s MGM era. And she told me that one night they were watching TV, Ed Sullivan and Elvis Presley was on TV. Mm-hmm. And she says she turned to her husband and she said, it's over. We're moving to New York. Mm-hmm. Our way of life is done. So she was like, and then, you know, they moved to New York. And she says that things changed after that.
With this musical, with Kiss Me, Kate, how much – there are things that I sense that you've added and messed around. For example, I don't want to wreck anything, but there's kind of a Second Amendment right to bear arms joke in there, which I don't think is in the original script. Did you play around with some things?
You know what? I actually didn't. I didn't add any of the lines. You know, within the Shakespeare's text, I've reorganized it slightly, but it's completely organized anyhow. Mm-hmm. You know, that's not the order of scenes in The Taming of the Shrew. Within the actual book, my understanding is that for the 99 Broadway revival is, from what I've heard, he's not credited, but John Guare adapted those scenes with a general, if that's what you're referring to. So that line, so a few of those lines, I think they may be Guare's contribution.
Right.
But it's very smart and the audience reacts. And it's kind of torn from the headlines, isn't it?
Yeah, so, it is totally torn from the headlines. The well, another aspect to this too, and I don't know how true this is with Kiss Me, Kate, but we know with Cole Porter that there sometimes are sort of parallel versions of the lyrics that Porter would write. Mm-hmm. Sort of the G or PG rated version of the lyric, but there would also be an R mm-hmm. or even X rated version of the lyric. And I was listening mm-hmm. in the show. I thought I caught one that it maybe is mm-hmm. popularly recorded in a slightly more PG version. Did that show up at all? Were there different versions of the lyrics?
Yeah. No, it didn't. We did the R-rated one, I assume.
Yeah, you did the R-rated.
But
yeah.
But what's interesting about it is in that way, the marriage of Cole Porter and William Shakespeare is perfect.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how I could teach Shakespeare in high schools, because when you go through some of his speeches and monologues, he's the raunchiest stage writer of all time. Cole Porter may be a second. So it's this wonderful combination of sophistication and raunchiness, that both of them have.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. I'll tell you during the break which one I think got changed. But it's in, mm-hmm. I'll tell you right now. It's in I'm Always True to You in My Fashion. Mm-hmm. I think some people, I think you do it. There's an oil man known as Tex who is keen to write me checks. Mm-hmm. But the checks I fear means the sex.
That sex is here to stay.
See, I think when people have recorded mm-hmm. it for pop,
I'm sure.
for radio,
oh, yes.
they take the word sex out and they put text back in for the second time. Yeah. So that's the kind of thing.
I forgot that they did that. Yeah.
Yeah.
In many popular recordings.
The the people who are, I think it's in the program there at Hartford Stage, that there was some thought initially among the producers of this show when it was first being conceived mm-hmm. not to use Cole Porter. He kind of had been through...
Can you imagine?
Yeah.
He, after his accident that left him crippled for the rest of his life mm-hmm. and kind of a recluse and in chronic pain, he had some commercially successful musicals, but they didn't produce his best music, most memorable songs. So for 10 years... he had kind of fallen out of favor, and then Kiss Me, Kate was a huge comeback and his biggest success. That was the first musical to win the Tony Award, and it was his longest run on Broadway.
You direct plays that are not musicals. Is there a big difference in the skill set? I mean, are you basically doing the same thing but with a little music added, or do you have to think differently about casting, about everything?
Well, I direct Shakespeare plays, contemporary plays, operas, mm-hmm. musicals, and what makes a great actor in each one of those genres is slightly different.
Mm-hmm.
And with musical theater, with a piece like this, it's actually very difficult singing technically.
Mm-hmm.
The ranges in some of the songs are extraordinary.
Yep.
Anastasia and Mike have some very, very difficult passages, I think, vocally. And then, on top of that, great musical theater actors have to be able to communicate the lyrics,
mm-hmm.
And that's a separate skill.
The ability to
hit the notes.
Right. So In Love is a very tough song. And I noticed for her, she's sort of in a coloratura range at one point and then in a belt voice range at another
point. That's one of the trickiest. I mean, I directed that show at Goodspeed, City of Angels,
mm-hmm.
and there's a song in that. That's the only thing I can compare it to that's very, very difficult. There's a torch song in that that's really tough. It's that belt and soprano mm-hmm. thing.
Mm-hmm. Your plays, I mean, every single play that I've ever seen that you've directed has these incredible visual signatures to them. And I mean, the way that art design is pulled together, the way that set design is pulled together, it's really astonishing. And in this show has one of your trademarks, which is that set pieces change so fast. I mean, the entire stage is reconfigured in the blink of an eye from one thing to another.
Yeah, and it's designed to give pleasure and... Tech was, it can get so unpleasant and demoralizing. It's so difficult because you build this beautiful thing in rehearsal
mm-hmm.
and you get to tech rehearsals. And until you get to the other side, which is what you're describing, it's brutal getting there because you have to try it again and again and something malfunctions. And then, you go through pages very quickly and then you get to a transition and everything grinds to a halt, So that's the irony about musicals is, they're populist entertainment by and large. They're designed to give pleasure, but working on them can at times be very stressful.
Yeah. Well, have you ever seen the movie Topsy Turvy?
Yes.
To me, that's part of the message of that movie, right? That
mm-hmm.
what's more joyous than a Gilbert and Sullivan musical, right? That's it has no other function really than to make people happy. Mm-hmm. And you just look at everybody and there's such stress cases, mm-hmm. and there's kind of montage at the end where you can see they are all absolutely at the end of their wits.
Yeah. Making people happy in theater is it can be brutal getting there.
I also wondered watching this. I was watching it. Well, first of all, I have to tell you that I was there on Tuesday night. You may remember what happened on Tuesday night.
I missed it, fortunately. Oh. It would have shortened my life. So,
you know, this is the second time I've had this happen in Hartford in the last 2.5 years. So at the beginning of the show on Tuesday night, there is fog, or there's some ambiance. Yeah, yeah. I would call it fog, I guess.
Yeah.
And it tripped out the fire alarms. Mm-hmm. And everybody looked around. First of all, I hear this kind of, you know, buzzing, humming, wailing, and I think, wow, Darko's really pulling out all the stops here. This is really interesting.
Sorry, no. You know?
Then it turns out we have to clear the theater, so the fire department. Mm-hmm. This happened at the Bushnell with Peter and the Starcatcher. I was in the audience that night.
Yeah.
We were out in the street for 25 minutes. This was very quick turnaround. But
Well, it was interesting because we found out the next day that it definitely wasn't the hazers.
It's not.
You know, that it wasn't that. So we did all the testing and everything, and at the top stairway, there was a malfunctioning, whatever that thing is, you know, in the hallway behind the theater. Either that or somebody was smoking near the garage, so we had to replace the equipment and stuff. So, believe me, I was on it right away. I was like, figure it out.
Right. It happened about two-thirds of the way through the overture, so it wasn't too hard. In terms of energy, it may have been difficult for the cast to reset and begin again, but not noticeably hard.
Well, what I heard, I wasn't there. You were there, but I heard that, you know, first line of the show is another opening, and I heard that when they started again, the crowd appreciated it.
He even dragged that out in a slightly, you know, dramatically weary way.
Oh, good opening. For him. Smart man.
Yeah. No, he actually, I think he milked it for that little extra laugh. I was looking, since I got to watch the overture twice, I was also thinking, I don't know, it made me wonder what you think of this play overall, because it obviously is a joyous thing. It is a wonderful little slice of perfect, you know, sweet cake. But I was even noticing the light cues and stuff at the beginning. There's a little bit of darkness that you play with, too. I don't know. I mean, it's not this big Ann Miller Technicolor thing that you're doing, you know? There is sort of this way in which at times the lights are a little bit muted and stuff like that. I mean, is there a little bit of the darkness in the play that
– Well, that sentiment, and I love the way Wayne who plays Pops sings that opening line, another – opening another show, because there's a weariness to it.
Yeah.
You know, theater, it takes its toll. And in the beginning, the idea, the first 60 seconds, was to kind of create a ghostly feeling of a theater, you know, and then coming to life. And then it bursts into life.
Yeah. But, I wondered if I was reading that right. All right. So we're going to move on to some other topics here. We're talking to Darko Treznik. He is the artistic director of the Hartford Stage Company. He is indeed staging Kiss Me, Kate right now. I don't think we should say too much more about it. You should go to it. I mean, I would say this if you weren't here. I will say it on a day that you're not here. There's sort of no excuse for empty seats in the Hartford Stage on this. This is like so much fun, and you will be depriving yourself unnecessarily if you miss this. So anyway, let's take a quick break. We'll come back with more of Darko.
When I'm close to you, dear, the stars fill the sky. So in love with you.
We're back. We're with Darko Treznik, Artistic Director of the Hartford Stage Company. I'm going to just quickly say also that we're doing this kind of roughly a week before you're hearing it, so don't call in. Well, you can call in, but no one will answer the phone. Otherwise, we'd be delighted to take phone calls and hear from you. So I do want to just sort of get to know you a little bit more. So as a boy growing up in Eastern Europe, I mean, we talked about you maybe loving some of those MGM musicals that came over in movie form, but were you kind of pointed in this direction the whole way? Were you a theatrical kid? Did everybody know you were going to be in the theater someday?
No, and yes. I mean, my family, I don't come from a theater background, but I think I directed my first show when I was 7 years old because I saw the Olympics on TV, opening ceremonies, and then I It's become a famous story, actually. Mm-hmm. And then I organized all the kids, and we cut cardboard medals, and I organized games like long-distance spitting, and we even lit the torch on the corner of my grandmother's house, which she was not happy with. But that was my first epic production. And then later on, this thing happened. We had two American Fulbright students living with us, and they started buying me all these American toys. Like, I was the only kid in Yugoslavia, in Belgrade, with a pogo stick. Mm-hmm. So if people wanted to play with my toys, they had to be in my shows. So toys are power, you know. So I started directing pretty early. And then in college, at Swarthmore College, I did some acting. Mm-hmm. And I quickly realized that I was a nightmare to work with because I just wanted to take over. Mm-hmm. And I was constantly finding flaws. Mm-hmm. So I realized that I was on the wrong side. So pretty quickly, you know, and at Swarthmore, I started doing plays like Skin of Our Teeth, The Skin of Our Teeth, mm-hmm. and The Visit with 20 or 30 people. And I didn't know that you were supposed to start with 2-3 actors. So I never learned that lesson. Yeah.
What was your first Shakespeare? When did you first direct?
In grad school, I was going through a really tough time. I went through a kind of a bad breakup, and I didn't want to have anything to do with directing Shakespeare, oddly enough, because it's not my first language. Mm-hmm. And I knew I could understand it, but I wasn't sure if I could feel it, and like a native speaker. And then I read The Winter's Tale, and it's one of his great plays. I think theater people really love The Winter's Tale, maybe mm-hmm. more than the general public, but it's all of life's tragedy and comedy rolled into one play. It's one of his most ambitious plays, and it just kind of spoke to me. And I directed it for my graduate thesis, and I got an agent out of it completely by accident. This man, his wife was an opera singer I knew, and he showed up, and he loved it, and he signed me on. And before I even graduated from Columbia, I kind of started directing operas and plays. And so I owe Shakespeare a lot, you know, but that was the first. And it's still one of my favorite plays. So
When you direct Shakespeare, there's such an incredible specific visual signature on what you're doing. I mean, it's now, for those of us who started to get used to your directing and to enjoy it, I mean, the first thing we look forward to is just walking in and thinking, seeing, okay, what kind of canvas is he painting on this time? And when you did The Tempest, it didn't look like any other Tempest I ever saw, you know, and it was so striking that, you know, I won't ever forget it. And I would say the same thing with Twelfth Night. I would say the same thing with Hamlet that you have. Do you start there? Do you sort of think, this it's going to look like this, and then I'll start figuring out other stuff?
You know, not at all. What's interesting is that, you know, I'm happy and I'm flattered when people talk about the visual, you know, information in my productions. And I work with some great designers, you know, and I share all of that credit with them. But the other thing is everything comes from the text, you know, so that everything comes from the relationship to the text, reading things very, very carefully. And I think, you know, like, and sometimes it is very personal. I mean, with The Tempest, there were those bookcases that were actually rock climbing walls. Mm-hmm. And a few years before, I kind of went through a tough time, and I didn't want to direct. I took 6 months off, and I joined a rock climbing gym. Mm-hmm. And the more I rock climbed, the more I thought about the potential of vertical space. And I was like, I'm going to use this when I get back to directing. And the first Shakespeare play after that was The Tempest. And there were those rock climbing spirits, you know, climbing the bookcases, Prospero's bookcases. So sometimes it is very personal. But I would like to think that it always starts with a text. So.
I think I visited you on the set of The Tempest, and you said that you'd also done some aerial work.
Yeah.
This thing kind of had aerialist in it.
If I hadn't started doing that earlier in my life, maybe I would be doing that instead of directing, because I love it.
Yeah.
I do love it. So I do as much as I can at my age. So.
You've mentioned a couple of times now going through a tough time. Are you a moody person?
Yes.
Yeah, you have moods? Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Incredible mood swings. But you know, theater, the wonderful thing about theater and the wonderful thing about directing is that, you know, a group of people get together and they put their best foot forward on a daily basis. And at the end of that, a group of individuals have collaborated on a work of art that takes place, you know, in a specific time and space, and it's a beautiful thing. Every play or musical or opera that comes together, it's a small miracle. It's a mm-hmm. very hopeful way to live, very positive. So so often, you know, if I'm having a tough time, just working makes me happy.
So. The I find myself, I feel like I have a pretty busy life, but I can't imagine what your life is like. I mean, just first of all, looking at a play like Kiss Me, Kate, the number of moving parts, sometimes physical, actual moving parts, but then all the other sort of artistic moving parts underneath this. It just seems like a million different decisions and therefore a million things that can go wrong and things that just need to be solved. I mean, I just assume this is like that you're putting in 20-hour days and jumping from – I mean, do you have any downtime?
Not recently, not at all. Yeah. No, actually. Yeah, and it's been since last year, since the Tonys, you know, I'm getting many offers. That's just, you know, that's not boasting. I'm just being honest.
Yeah.
So it's my time to work very hard. Mm-hmm. But I have, you know, I have a wonderful home with my husband, Josh, and our dog, Hector. So that's I'm much more domestic than people think. So that if I have time away, mm-hmm. I like to be at home mm-hmm. and I like to cook. We both like to cook, you know.
Is Hector another bulldog? You had a bulldog at one point, right?
We had an English bulldog, and yeah. Hector is a French bulldog. So,
okay.
Yeah.
So you're going to do Romeo and Juliet next, right? I mean,
yeah.
Among Shakespeare plays. That's
sure,
the next
yes.
thing in the repertoire.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
I want to go back to something that you said because I think it's really important, which is that you start with the text and you stay with the text. Mm-hmm. And I think that was especially true of your Hamlet. Everybody who does Hamlet feels like, well, I've got to put some kind of gloss on it, right? I've got to have it take place in Nazi Germany, or it's got to be, you know. And
sure.
And of the Hamlets that I've seen, this is the one where I think I said to you afterwards, what I was reminded of is that this is a ripping good yarn. This is just a really good story.
Yeah.
You don't really actually have to, you know, set it in Washington, D.C. or something like that. It's just a really good story if you could just sort of get over all that. So Romeo and Juliet, you have a little bit of the same problem, right? It's been done a lot of times. And a lot of people put different glosses on it. And Baz Luhrmann sets it in, you know, in L.A. with guns and stuff like that. What are you just going to, once again, just go right back to the text and say, what is this story?
Sure. And when I go back to the text, it doesn't mean that it's going to be a you know, an Elizabethan production. I have no idea yet because I have three productions between from now and when I start directing Romeo and Juliet. But you know, what's interesting about Romeo and Juliet is that it's a fairly early play.
Mm-hmm.
And I call it the Carmen of Shakespeare plays. You know, Carmen, the opera, has some very famous parts.
Mm-hmm.
And then you have to get through some really tricky plotting. And that's the same thing with Romeo and Juliet. It's actually not his most perfect plot. It's a work of a young playwright. So I've been struggling with that for a long time. So we'll see where we land. You know, Juliet has some famous monologues. There are terrific scenes with Romeo and Mercutio. But there's some very tricky things to figure out. So I'm still struggling with it.
I think the other question, I mean, have you answered the question? I struggled with this a lot. And I think I've had some arguments with your friend Humphrey Tonkin about this a few times, too. I'm not even sure exactly I understand. The decision that I made about Romeo and Juliet is that to some degree it's about adolescent sexuality and that the sense that once it's kindled, it's a very difficult thing to rein in and it freaks adults out, you know, that these people, they're in love, their hormones are jacked up, they're probably a little bit more violent because of that. They're just these wild, out of control things going on. And at the level of Montague and Capulet elders, it's just they're wrong and they're just out of control. And what are we going to do about them? But I'm not really sure that's necessarily Shakespeare's take that Romeo and Juliet are wrong.
Yeah, I mean, what's interesting is it's called Romeo and Juliet, and we think about the play in terms of those two characters, but their story only makes sense in relation to the community that surrounds them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something I've been thinking about a great, great deal. Like, who are the Capulets? Who are the Montagues? You know, those first few lines in Fair Verona, how fair is Verona? Is it an ironic statement?
Mm-hmm.
And not everything that Shakespeare has to be taken at face value. And then the other thing, you know, Jack O'Brien, one of my mentors, you know, he said something, you know, just because it's called Romeo and Juliet, it doesn't mean that they're really central to the lives of the rest of that community.
Right.
You could actually say that they're marginalized, you know. They're important because they take center stage for us, the audience. The place that they take, how they're treated by the rest of the community could be quite different.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what's on my mind lately, yeah.
the last Juliet at Hartford stage was Calista Flockhart.
Yeah.
That was a very, you know how some actors spray a little bit more when they're speaking? That, that had a lot of sprayers in it, that particular cast. You know, I felt like they should give ponchos or something to the people in the first three or four roles. Everybody's on their S's.
That kind of spray.
Yeah, those kind of S's and P's and stuff like that. Yeah. They were just, there was a lot of saliva in the air. It was a damp production of Romeo and Juliet. Yeah. We're talking to Darko Trejnik right now.
Well, if you go to Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder, you know, it's a sweaty production because if you're in the front row, you get pelted because those two guys, there's like sweat pouring over, off them. So it's not exactly the same thing.
Yeah, I don't remember getting damp at that one. We're talking to Darko Trejnik. Since you just mentioned Gentleman's Guide, I wonder if there was a Gentleman's Guide joke in Kiss Me, Kate, and that is those two doors. There are doors in the dressing room that kind of face each other. And of course, probably the most famous, the iconic scene, if there is one, in Gentleman's Guide involves those two sets of doors. Were you having a little joke about yourself in designing it that way, or just like doors?
That's actually how it's done traditionally in Kiss Me, Kate, so it's just kind of a sheer coincidence. But I was wondering if people would think about that and expect me to top myself, you know, from Gentleman's Guide, which Kiss Me, Kate does not give you the opportunity to do. But there is that one scene where I crowded 19 bodies inside of that little dressing room, which is a nod to Marx Brothers.
I thought it might be Marx Brothers.
Oh, completely.
Yeah, the stateroom, all right. So, yeah, we're going to take a little break here. We'll be back for one last segment talking to Darko Trejnik. We'll talk a little bit more about some of the things that are coming up in his life, including Hitchcock on the stage after this.
Brush up your Shakespeare. Start quoting him now. Brush up
your Shakespeare, and the women, you. Wait, they're doing Rear Window at Hartford Stage? Can I take you to dinner? Can I take you to dinner? I don't really do Jimmy Stewart, do I? Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin. The part of Bill Curry was played by Howard Keel. For show pages, articles, and photos of the Faith Middleton Show staff and Elizabethan Jerkins, visit our website WNPR.org/Colin. On tomorrow's show, what it means to be Jewish. And now, back to Colin.
We're back with Darko Trejnik, Artistic Director of Hartford Stage. Go see Kiss Me, Kate. It runs through June 14th. And if you let it go longer than that, you're going to feel really... I mean, it really is just a great production, and I would say this. Were he not here, get your tickets now to this. So, Wolfie, maybe we could just play a little of what it sounds like when Darko Trejnik wins the Tony.
I would like to thank my artistic home, Hartford Stage. My husband, Josh. I love you. Robert and Steve and a beautiful cast headed by Jefferson Mays. And I should thank so many people, but most of all, my mom literally taught me how to jump out of airplanes. She fought during the Second World War. She was a skydiver in the 1940s. She's 87 years old, and she's too frail to be here tonight, so I'm going to thank her. So... Mama, volim te, hvala ti za sve što si mi dala. Volim te mnogo, drži se. Thank you very much.
So tell us just a little bit more about your mom. This sounds like quite a story. Yeah. Who was she?
Well, her father was a captain of a riverboat on the Danube. So, you know, she spent her youth going up and down the river. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, during the occupation, it basically became a floating concentration camp where there were kind of prisoners on board. And, you know, my grandfather would wake them all up in the middle of the night, and they would boil water and they would stick it under the produce, under these wire meshes so that everything would rot by the time it got to Germany. And her brother fought during the resistance. And, you know, she's 88 now, and the last time I was home, she was telling me about hiding Jewish people you know, and taking them to safety on the boat, hiding them under the coal and in the bottom of the boat, and her little and how her little brother would shake. Oh, he was so scared. Mm-hmm. So that was extraordinary enough. And then after the Second World War, she was part of that generation that helped rebuild the country mm-hmm. out of the rubble. And somehow that led to working at airports. And she was never a part of the Communist Party, but I asked her that, and she wasn't. But somehow she became a part of this, youth group, and she was one of the first women skydivers, parachuters at the time, when you had to jump out of the airplane without tandem.
Yeah.
So eventually, like, I knew, I was like, if my mom did it, well, I have to do it, you know. So I did some skydiving, and then I called her afterwards, and it's wonderful to bond with your mom. You know, about skydiving.
Yeah, so, I guess. I mean, I'm...
Yeah. You should try it. It's great.
My mother was much tamer. That's still an amazing story. So the one day you're a Tony nominee and the next day you're a Tony winner. You just alluded to it, but I mean, I assume... The Tony's a Tony. It's a prize. You already directed a great play. You directed lots of other great plays. It didn't really change anything. Mm-hmm. But I suppose at another level, it did change everything.
Oh, it changes a lot.
Yeah.
It changes a lot. And, career-wise, it does make a huge change. And it has made a huge change this season for Hartford Stage.
Mm-hmm.
Our subscriptions, single tickets, everything is way up. Now, some of that has something to do with the work that we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
But then, some of it probably has something to do with Tony's too. So, and career-wise, I am getting the kind of offers and meetings, and I'm able to start certain projects, and I'm able to bring a lot of attention to Hartford Stage because of it. So practically, it does change things. You know, it's disingenuous to pretend otherwise. Yeah.
While I was watching the Tonys when you won, like everybody else in Hartford, I'm up and whooping and yelling, yeah, Hartford, Darko. And then I'm thinking, he just won a Tony. That might not be so good in a way. I think people are terrified that you're going to leave Hartford. Can you make this work? I mean, given the amount of demands there are on you and the number of people who want to work with you in other places, can you make Hartford work as a home base?
Yes. For now, absolutely. And, 10, 15 years from now, who can say, anything. But right now, what I love the most about Hartford Stage is our audience.
Mm-hmm.
And I really mean that. It's a very special relationship between a theater and its audience. And, this year we did a play, Reverberation. It's as big a risk as I could take. I had people who have been subscribing for 30, 40, 50 years saying, well, why aren't we doing more of this kind of provocative new work?
Mm-hmm.
And that says something really special about this community. So it's great. And, when the theater does well and it helps the city do well, it's a tactile relationship,
Mm-hmm.
The size of the city is so great. Like in New York, I'm one of many,
mm-hmm.
I don't so much struggle with confidence. I just struggle with why. Why do I need to be here when I'm in New York? And so I love Hartford and Hartford Stage.
Well, I think the lesson of Hartford Stage is you can do Reverberations, which has nudity mm-hmm. as gay sex.
And we only have one theater,
Yeah.
We don't have most companies would go like, let's put it in a 100-seat theater.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure that I want to do that. Like, why marginalize something to a small space? So
you can do that, but you can't do Richard Foreman. I think that's the lesson of Hartford Stage Company. You can do something that has a basically linear narrative. The content is they'll put up with anything.
But what's interesting is we did the piece with Baryshnikov a few years ago, and that was completely nonlinear.
It was nonlinear,
and I think people embraced it.
That was because of my voice. My voice carried that production. Come on,
was
I'm serious about
it? Yes,
that's the reason
probably.
People like the show.
Yes, probably that's the case.
but as you probably know, famously, then they did Pearls. I think it was with Pearls for Pigs, whatever it was. I mean, that's the one time I've seen a real rebellion in the Hartford mm-hmm. Stage audience, and they had to have.
It's a legendary rebellion. I've missed it. It's years before I came, but I wish, I could have seen what happened.
Well, it does seem as though, for any art form, rebellion is also kind of good as long as it doesn't financially destroy you, right? Like, visual art, museum art was more exciting when there was Mapplethorpe. Then it is – there's nothing like that now.
Absolutely.
And, when there's lines around the block and half of the people are there to protest and half the people are there because they got to get in and see it, there is something great about that.
Yeah. And the thing is, again, Jack O'Brien said, be careful about giving the audiences sugar all the time, because then they show up for sugar. You know what I mean? And then soon you change your public, and then you can't do all kinds of programming that you dream of doing.
So, So we do have to talk about the fact that you're going to do a stage adaptation of Hitchcock's Rear Window.
Actually,
it's
Cornell Woolrich's Rear Window, so we don't have the rights to the Hitchcock movie. Right. This is based on the story.
You mean the fact that I've been practicing my Jimmy Stewart impersonation all afternoon is meaningless
to
you?
It is meaningless. It is. I'm so sorry. I'm dying to hear it, though, so I'm dying to hear it. But it's based on the story that inspired the Hitchcock movie, and the story, it takes place in 1940s, and the setting is a little bit more 1940s film noir, a little bit grimier, a little bit sweatier. It's a little bit like B-noir stage thriller is what I'm thinking about right now.
Do you love the movie too?
I love the movie.
Yeah.
It's a masterpiece, and there's no point in doing something exactly the same.
Right, right. You wouldn't
so this is much more based on the original story. The thriller aspect is the same. What happens in the apartment, you know,
right,
and who the main character is completely different.
I have good trivia about the movie.
You
may already know
it.
So the guy, the piano player, the guy who's a piano player?
Oh.
One of the guys who played the piano. That's Ross Bagdasarian, who is, first of all, I think a first cousin of William Saroyan.
Uh-huh.
And this will be meaningful to somebody who grew up in Eastern Europe, meaningless to somebody who grew up in Eastern Europe, I'm guessing, but was the guy who created Alvin and the Chipmunks.
You are right.
You're right.
I have a vague notion of Alvin and the Chipmunks.
Yeah. But for people listening at home anyway, go back and watch Rear Window. The guy playing the piano is the guy who created Alvin and the Chipmunks. So I think it was the case that when you first accepted at Hartford Stage, you had recently worked with F. Murray Abraham on Merchant of Venice. You said at the time you wanted to work with him again. So are you going to get him to Hartford Stage?
I hope so. And we're talking about it. And, you know, schedules are complicated. And then finding, a role that's, that sparks his imagination. And, he's one of the great actors I work with. I just had it was truly an extraordinary experience. I just worked with Patti LuPone for the first time, and it just blew my mind. It's one of the really greatest actors that I've ever worked with, you know, a classically trained actress with that legendary singing voice, and she was sensational to work with. So I hope to do something with her. And I think that's the great thing about, you know, my job is I get to work with these amazing people.
Is there a thread that connects them? Is there a quality that connects them? They all have great something. Finish that sentence.
Infinite life behind the eyeballs.
Yeah.
You know, when you see it, that alertness behind the eyes, you know, and I think that's one of the definitions of star quality. You know, like when you're in the room with Patty, you feel that much more alive.
Yeah.
You know.
Are there actors or possibly playwrights that you're really just dying to get to Hartford, dying to work with them here?
Absolutely. And, you know, sometimes we commission pieces, sometimes it's revivals. I mean, Keith Rudin wrote this beautiful play called Life and Limb. And I saw it years ago and read it, and I've toyed with the idea of reviving it. It's one of my favorite American plays in recent history. Well, he happens to be the guy who adapted Rear Window. It's his adaptation. It's filtered through his superb, you know, taste and sensibility. And so he's somebody. And, you know, we have a commissioning program. There are some young playwrights whose work I really love.
How about actors? Are there actors that you kind of lure here somehow?
Oh, all the time.
Yeah.
You know, and the thing about it is, you know, it has to be a good match with a role.
Yeah.
It has to be a perfect match. And sometimes, you know, somebody tells you that they want to do something, And then you do that play for them, you know, so that's like a star vehicle. But it just has to be a perfect match, because if it's not, then they don't succeed, the theater doesn't succeed. So it has to be a good fit.
Are you prepared to name names? Anybody you're trying to get?
No, not yet. You know, the problem with saying who's going to come, what ends up happening is
if they don't,
then people are disappointed.
Who you want to come? Somebody you've never had a conversation with.
You know who I love? This is she actually acted at Hartford Stage in the 70s. I love Sigourney Weaver, and I just met her last year, and I said, hey, if you ever want to come back and do something, because she went to this school.
She went to YDS, yeah.
Yeah. What is the school?
Yale Drama School, right?
No, she went to Yale Drama School, but she went to the elementary school, the boarding school here. What is the Ethel Walker?
Oh, Ethel Walker.
Yes,
that
she went there. She went there.
I didn't
so
know
she's
that.
A local girl, you know. But I just spend I spend a little bit of time in her company, and I didn't act like an idiot because she's one of the few people. There are very few people that I'm starstruck around. So
yeah,
I'd like to work with her. Yeah.
I'm trying to think. What the theatrical role is, though? That would be an interesting thing to think about.
Well, my friend Terrence McNally just did the musical of The Visit, so it's not the right play to do. But I wanted to do The Visit with Sigourney Weaver for the longest time. So something else will come along.
Can you go to New York or somewhere else and sit and watch a play and not like? And just enjoy it and not be mentally directing.
Oh yeah, absolutely. And there's nothing that I love more than going up to a director afterwards and saying that's absolutely wonderful. Generosity, it's so important. And I just saw The Curious Incident of Dog in the Nighttime.
Mm-hmm.
It's so superb. It's beautiful. And many of my friends, some of them have acted at Hartford Stage or in it.
Yeah.
And it's just absolutely terrific. That was that's my favorite thing that I've seen lately.
I saw both Aya and Akhtar plays in New York at the same time. So I saw Disgraced on Broadway, and then I went down to the New York Theater Workshop and saw Invisible Hand. That's a terrific play. He's an amazing player. He'd be great.
He just won the OB.
I think maybe at least 1% of the cast of that won the OB too.
Yeah.
And so explain what you won. You won for an Ionesco play, right?
Yeah, The Killer with Michael Shannon. Michael is somebody I would love to bring here. He's the guy from the Boardwalk Empire and
Superman.
Revolutionary Road.
Yes.
No, that's not the movie.
He's the crazy brother.
Road. No, but he introduced me to this play, The Killer, by Ionesco, and it was just wonderful. It wasn't on my front burner, but it was a chance to work with him, and it turned out really good.
Because so many of those certain actors, it's hard to imagine that he's going to be able to do Sky Masterson or something, because he's all you ever really know him for are these incredibly intense and usually pretty dark roles where these characters will do almost any. That character in Boardwalk Empire, at a certain point, you realize this person will do anything. There's nothing that they can.
And what was fascinating about The Killer is that the character who played was like the goofy version of that character. It's actually like the world's worst detective that he played. So I think, I was wondering, I never asked Michael, but I was wondering if he was like parodying his role on Boardwalk Empire, if it was like some kind of emotional exorcism. So
I assume he's not that guy we see in I assume he's a semi-normal, happy-go-lucky person, or is that intensity just kind of always there?
Physically, he's one of the most striking people that I've ever met, so he can't help that. That's just physiognomy. He is like really, it's a fascinating face, skull. But he, he's a family man and fairly quiet and actually very goofy, very, very funny and goofy to work on stage, very inventive. Yeah.
We've got about a minute left. Is there anything else you want to say about next season at Hartford Stage?
We mentioned Romeo and Juliet and Rear Window. And at the end of the season, we're doing a world premiere of Anastasia and a big musical written by the authors of Ragtime. And we're doing a play called An Opening in Time by Chris Shin, wonderful Connecticut playwright, a play set in Connecticut about a high school production, partially about a high school putting on a production of Rent.
Mm-hmm.
So it has a local angle. Body of an American by Dan O'Brien, which is kind of our most esoteric offering for the year. It's a play that won the first Kennedy Prize for playwriting and Having Our Say. So something for everyone.
And will you ever get a week of rest, ever?
I'm going to try this summer. Going to try this summer to take about 3 weeks off after Kiss Me, Kate opens in San Diego. I think we might go to Palm Springs.
That sounds like a very good idea and a very well-deserved concept, Darko Treznik. Given how busy you are, thank you for taking an hour out of your life
to
talk to me.
Thank you so much.
A G.I. for his cutie pie is not, 'cause it's too darn hot. It's too darn hot. It's too.